Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. It's nice to be here with you and all our listeners of the next chapter with Charlie. Today, I'll be visiting once again with my friend, Taryn Voget. Last week, Taryn and I talked about loving yourself and putting yourself first, which we've received some pretty strong responses to, because it is such a unique idea, or I don't know if unique, it's terribly important. Toward the end of the show, Taryn brought up a recent opportunity that she had to lead a small group of co-workers at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation on how to discover your genius. The little workshop was a hit, and she tells me it's now being requested by several teams at the foundation. Obviously, the thought of everyone having a genius within captured my curiosity. So I asked Taryn if she would be willing to come back and do another show and give tips to me and our listeners on how each of us might discover our own genius. I can't wait for what's going to come of this chat. But before I bring her on, let me tell you a bit about the Everyday Genius. Taryn Voget is the CEO and co-founder of the Everyday Genius Institute, which you can find at everydaygenius.institute.com. It's an education company that deconstructs how geniuses think and then teaches those strategies to people who want to shave years off their learning curves on topics that are important to them. She is an expert in genius and high-performance thinking and lights up when she can help people discover and expand their own unique genius. Taryn believes that everyone has a genius, and today she will tell us the process she uses to help us discover our own genius. As you can imagine, I am eager to see what transpires in this show, so let's welcome back my dear friend and genius, Taryn Voget. So, Taryn, what's up?
Hi, Charlie. What a great intro. Thank you. I'm so happy to be back. Thanks for asking me back. It was fun to hear that intro because I do light up when I get to think about helping people see their genius. So I'm so thrilled to be able to do this with you and our listeners today.
Yeah, and I can say that is truthful because I've seen you light up when you see other people's talents and you know I'm going to wrestle with the word genius until we get there, but that's part of our discussion. Let's begin this with a bit of background on the Everyday Genius. How in the world did you come up with this, what I might call, most innovative idea?
It started when I really burned out on corporate consulting. I'd spent the first, 10 or 12 years of my career doing these big, massive, complex system implementation projects for large global companies. And after, a decade of doing this, I really burned out and thought, you know, I've helped everyone else be successful in their projects, but I want to do something that's mine, that lights me up, that I can build all on my own. And I took some time off of work and spent a few months really trying to figure out, like, what is that? I had no idea. And I knew what I wanted. I wanted to be able to help people. I wanted to feel good helping people see things in a different way. And I was, at the time, very passionate about studying psychology and human behavior. It's always been something I've interested in, but at that particular moment in time, I was just really deep into it. And I was driving over the Golden Gate Bridge one day, and it literally felt like a bolt of lightning hit my head, and I saw the whole idea for what is now the Everyday Genius Institute just come to me in a flash and a vision. And what that was, it was one of those, I call them, like, big moments of inspiration with a capital I. You know, they don't come very often. When they do, they're really cool. And what I saw was a way to teach people how to be really good at something in a very simple way. And you think of the dummies guides, you know, let's say you want to learn to play guitar or cook Chinese food. You might go and buy yourself a dummies guide. Well, what you realize is that the dummies guide is actually quite hard. It's not for dummies. There's a lot of content and a lot of information. And it feels overwhelming. And I thought, well, what if we actually made a true dummies guide, but it was based on genius? And I thought that paradox was quite funny.
I love the dummies guide for genius.
Yeah. And so it's kind of what it became, where synchronistically, I ended up meeting this guy later that day who is widely considered one of the top wine tasters in the world and educates people on becoming master sommeliers. His name is Tim Gazer, and he is truly a genius wine taster. And he was passionate about learning how to understand how people really taste and analyze wine so that he could teach better. And I thought, oh, my God, this is crazy. He's the perfect person to do our first Everyday Genius project on. How could we deconstruct on a subconscious level what he does to analyze a wine and use that to teach other people that wanted to be better at wine tasting to do the same in a much more efficient way. So really, Everyday Genius is focused on strategy, not necessarily content. And the difference is important. So content would be, you know, what are the grapes, what are the regions, what are the styles of wine? That's content. Strategy is how do you analyze and evaluate a wine? That's strategy. So we at the Everyday Genius Institute focus on strategy, knowing that content is always a piece of it. But strategy is where the magic is.
Oh, that's I love that. That it's not the what as much as it is the how.
Mm-hmm. And so we kicked off the Everyday Genius Institute doing our very first project on wine genius. And it was so cool. And I remember being on the film set, which, by the way, at the time was in my living room. We taped up all the windows and made it into a film set that looks completely professional. You think we were in a studio if you were to see the video online. And interviewed and deconstructed Tim Gazer's wine tasting strategy. And I remember pausing on the set and having this moment when we figured out kind of the difference that makes all the difference in how somebody evaluates a wine. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to change the world. And it has. It's taken a little longer than I thought it would. I thought people would instantly get what we discovered, which is how we recognize smell, how our brain recognizes smell. I believe it's the first time in the world anyone's ever really figured that out. And so it was this really cool revelation. And now Tim Gazer has completely changed how he teaches wine tasting and how he teaches students. And he's just getting these phenomenal results. And it's changing really the whole world of wine education and learning how our own internal thoughts and patterns determine how we go about analyzing a wine. So it's quite fascinating. And that was the first project we did. We later have done ones on strategies of genius for copywriting, which is writing advertising copy or marketing strategies of genius. I did one on study strategies for straight A students. And then probably the most interesting one for me was the one I did with a kid whisperer on how she communicates with kids. And it was on, you know, parenting and talking with kids.
Oh, is that Heather by any chance?
That is Heather, who I think has been on the show before.
Yeah, she's been on the show, yes.
Yeah, Heather Criswell. And so I say all of that because we've had all these projects, there's others that I haven't mentioned, and I took a moment a while back and looked at it and said, but what are the common strategies across all of these people that are genius? And it came to me about what really the recipe for genius is and how we can, and what are the patterns of it. And how, when I stop to think about it, all of us have strategies of genius in certain contexts. And to pause and notice that is so profound because you think genius is beyond me, but genius is not beyond any of us. Genius is something that we already do. And when we stop to realize that we already do it, we can take it to the next level. And that's what's been fun for me lately is kind of moving a little bit away from deconstructing other strategies of genius and putting that in an education package and more into helping the everyday person see how they're already a genius and how to amplify that.
So that leads right to my question. I think my listeners, along with myself, have some reservation, Taryn, about considering ourselves genius. Really, almost no one considers themselves a genius. So I guess the first thing I think we need to do is get your definition so we're all on the same page of what is genius, because I can feel the pushback already. Say, wait a minute, well, yeah, I have no genius.
And it's a word I've struggled with too, because it is a word that seems impossible to achieve. And by the way, not even Einstein, if you were to read about Einstein, not even Einstein believed he was a genius. I have never met anybody, even though I've met some of the best in the world at what they do, that thinks they're a genius. It's like the bar is too high. But what I realized is the problem is deeper. So before I get to the definition of what I believe it is, I'm going to sort of tee this up a little bit, which is the problem is that we are relying on outsiders to tell us whether we're a genius or not. So the control of genius is beyond us. Like, I'll give you the dictionary definition of genius is a person who is exceptionally intelligent or creative, either generally or in some particular respect. The problem with that definition is, who is judging what exceptionally or intelligent or creative is? What's the measurement? You know, and who's doing the judging? And when you realize that there is no measurement and there is nobody judging, it becomes an impossible definition. So the reason nobody thinks they're a genius is because the definition of achieving it is impossible. Because we don't have these metrics and we don't have a group of people. And by the way, if we were waiting on the world to tell us whether we were a genius, I mean, Van Gogh painted, I think, 1,000 paintings in his life. He sold one. Lots of people, I think it was Emily Dickinson and others, have had these massive works come out after their death. So certainly if we're waiting in our lifetime to be recognized as a genius, we may wait our whole lifetime and not see that. So we can't put the definition of genius outside of ourselves for someone else to evaluate. So then that led me to...
I love that idea. I want to stop that right there because I think that was a profound thought, is that we can't let our definition of genius be controlled by someone outside of ourselves.
Correct.
So we are the determiner of our genius.
Yes, precisely. So how do we put the expression of genius and the evaluation of genius inside our own control so that we know when we have these moments of genius and we feel good about it, regardless of what anybody else says or thinks? Because I can't even tell you how many times I do stuff and people, maybe 10% of people get it, 80% don't, and another 10% think it's complete and total garbage. So if I'm waiting for the world to catch up to my innovative, cutting-edge thoughts of how something might look or feel or be, and I'm waiting for the world to catch up, I mean, genius is by definition on the cutting edge of creation. So not everyone's going to get it right away. It may take a hot minute. So we can't let the world determine whether we're a genius or not. We have to determine that for ourselves. And then the question is, well how do we do that? I mean, we're going to get to that on the next part of this, but my definition of genius. And by the way, we think of genius as a noun, like, I am a genius, she is a genius, but nobody feels like a genius. Nobody feels like a genius all the time. Certainly, if you were to watch me in the kitchen, you would not see me as a genius. I am not a great cook. And yet, in other contexts, I really shine. So the problem with genius, too, is that it's the expectation is way too high. We cannot be a genius in every context. And yet, in some moments, we do. And so I like to think of genius a different way. I like to think of genius as a verb. I am geniusing, right? Wow, she was really geniusing. Or I witnessed a moment of genius, right? So it can be a moment of genius, or it can be a verb, but to call somebody a genius, the bar is too high. So, like, let's just recognize that and say, okay, but how do you be in the act of expressing genius, or how do you have a genius moment? And so genius for me is the intersection of three things coming together. Number one, the very first thing is I've never, ever seen what I would call genius presence without there being passion and excitement for somebody doing that thing. And it could be, there's a girl on my team, for example, who's just a master politician, and she's administrative staff, but she just has a genius for getting people to kind of align around something that she wants. And it's masterful, and she's a genius at it, right? Other people are masterful at thinking about design in a certain way. I know somebody who's just a master at communication and communication with love. And so there's always a passion for it, though. There's an excitement, like a desire to want to be better at something. So the very first thing is, you know, that element has to be present. I've never seen genius present without some level of passion or excitement.
Okay.
Second thing is good strategy, and this is where it really gets into the meat of genius. And there's, I'd say, sort of five patterns of strategy that I've seen, and we can get into that in more detail, too. But the really good strategy, and good strategy really focuses on very high-quality goals. And let me break that down for a second, which is good strategy is high-quality goals. So if you think about, well, tasting wine, you know, what are your goals when you go to drink wine or cook, you know? And even people that, let's just take cooking, because almost everybody on some context or level does that, which is, what are your goals? You know, your goals might be to, if you're a chef like my brother-in-law, to bring out the natural flavors in their best form so that you can taste the essence of that ingredient, right? That's his goal.
Right.
Versus me is, how do I make something quick, healthy, and that I can eat multiple times this week because I don't want to cook?
right.
So the goal is going to determine the behavior. So when someone is really good at what they do, they are just operating from very high quality goals, and the behavior that they're doing is all in service to meeting those goals. So,
are the behaviors the strategies?
Yeah, like the how, right? Like, okay. Well, how do I go about achieving my goal of bringing out the, or my brother-in-law bringing out the essence of each ingredient? Like, how does he do that?
Right.
Right? It's the how. And, for example, it's very different. Like, I enjoy wine. It's very different. My goal is I want to enjoy wine, and I want it to be paired nicely with what I'm eating, which is very different from Tim Gazer, the master sommelier, whose goal is to analyze and evaluate the quality and structure of a wine. You can imagine that when he goes to drink a glass of wine, he's going to have a very different, like, experience than I am drinking wine because
yes.
we have very different goals. So the difference between somebody okay at what they do and somebody brilliant at what they do is the difference in how high quality those goals are. So that's the other thing, right? And then the last piece is really around this idea of channeling or inspiration. And we often think of, you know, like I told you the story of driving over the Golden Gate Bridge and having this literally lightning bolt moments of inspiration. I mean, those do happen. They happen very rarely, but they do happen. The far more frequent inspiration or intuition comes on much smaller levels, sort of the lowercase I, little moments of like, hey, what if I did that? Or hey, what about this idea? Or what if I asked this question of this person? Like, what would, you know? And so there are these little inspirations and little intuitions that guide us along the way, but it's the same mechanism, which is sort of tapping into something bigger than us to guide us.
Does it come from without, Taryn? I mean, is it something, I know it's an inner thing bursting out, but is it a feeling that it's come from somewhere else, or do you think you strategically plan that part out or identify that part? Did that make sense?
Yeah, and it's hard for me to talk about genius without talking about some level of spirituality, because to me they absolutely go together. And I don't mean woo-woo spirituality. I mean, like, what is the essence of the human spirit, and how does it really operate and work? And so people often think that, well, you know, God is this thing outside of me, you know, and they have these constructs of what God may or may not be. What I have come to discover in my research on genius is that there is an aspect of that source energy, of that universal light, of that God force inside each of us. And so it really is kind of a esoteric question of where does that inspiration come from? Does it come from outside of us or inside of us?
Okay.
But if God is all that is, then we are an aspect of it. So it maybe is a bit of both.
Right? Yeah. I lost track of my question because it was a good one, doggone it. Let's just go ahead and move on.
Yeah, so what I would say, so then to really answer your question, is what is the definition of genius? And what I would say is genius is a process. It's a verb. It's those moments sometimes that happen of inspiration. But really what it is the light of the creative force of the universe focused through us. Like, we are the focus through our passion, our excitement, and our goals of that creative energy and that light to achieve moments of brilliance.
And the whole process is engineered strategically, except for perhaps the inspiration.
Right, like, you know, you see those cool prisms, and if you were to have a prism over, let's say, like a lawn or like a dry lawn, how you could almost light a fire, right? it's taking the light of the sky, the light of the sun, the light of all of it, and it's focusing that light through the prism into a very specific spot onto the ground, powerful enough to literally ignite something. Right?
We are that
prism. And through our focus and our strategy and our passions
and our inspiration.
The light and our inspiration, right? We are focusing that light. That light of like the infinite creative energy of the universe, the light of the sun, so to speak, that creativeness. And we're focusing it into this laser that is powerful enough to literally light something on fire or have these moments and to create something beautiful. And by the way, the something beautiful could be, you say, the perfect thing to a child in the moment, right? Like, they're not always like, oh, my God, I just invented free energy. And that can happen, too. But, you know, like I said, the little eyes are far more common than the big eyes of inspiration.
Tell me now, as I'm thinking about genius and I'm trying to think about, you know, how our listeners are perceiving all of this. Is genius, according to your definition, is it any way talent contingent or talent related? Like my skills, my gifts, my talents that, you know, you say you're not, you're a cook who cooks to eat, you know, not a cook who cooks to amaze. Is that because of talents or is that because of passion? What is it?
I don't have the interest, right? Like, it's pretty hard to be a genius chef, a genius project manager, a genius artist, and a genius, you know, lover and parent, like, all at once. Like, all of those take so much focus. Like, how would you have enough hours in a day, right? Like, in order to focus, you kind of have to, like, what is the definition of focus? Move things aside and focus on a few, right?
Right.
And so I think genius, when we're really operating at a high level in something, it takes a certain focus and desire and passion. And so I think we have a lot of skills. Like, over our life, we build a lot of skills. But that's a little different to me than focusing genius, right? Like, one of the things that I'm passionate about is taking complex things and making them simple. It's a skill that I've developed. I have moments of genius with that, right? And so it's in any context, whether I'm doing training material, I'm speaking to an audience, I'm working on a project, you know, it's like, I find joy in taking complex things and making them simple. I've developed that muscle. And I'll do it in any context, right?
Right.
I've also got skills of writing. You know, I've written books. Is it my total passion? You know, sometimes I enjoy it, yeah. So I don't know. It's hard to say because it's like people think, oh, I just have one genius and one genius only. Well, that's not totally true. It's like, what do you want to focus on and how excited are you to be better and better and better at it?
So it's going to be the scope is narrow in what you're going to be genius at.
Yeah, like
depending on your passion, your goals and strategies, and the inspiration that comes through.
Right. Now, let's take you, and I know you pretty well, so let's take you as a great example, and maybe our listeners can relate to this. You've had a long career doing a number of different things, and very, very different things in a sense, right?
Right.
You know, working with the church, working with corporations, and now doing this radio show, and a lot of other things in between. Of course, you've got your art, you've got other things too. What, if you were to look back over your life, is there a common thread where that you've applied to all of those different pursuits?
Is that a question?
Yeah, it's a question.
That's a very difficult question. That was when I wish I had time to ponder. Okay, what do I bring in? I believe I'm very strong with empathy, identifying where a person is and what a person needs, and being able to deliver that sort of emotional and or intellectual feedback that helps them feel better about themselves.
Beautifully said, and I would agree with that knowing you. And so to just maybe shorten that in a sentence, like, to help people feel better about themselves.
Right? Oh, it is, yes.
Yeah, and you've done
but it begins with But it begins with context. Empathy.
Yeah, so then there's a strategy, right? Like, how do you do that? Well, I have
okay. This,
I do that.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
But the gift that you love sharing is being able to do that, and you do it in every single context. And so genius is often like that, right? Like, we think that genius is this big thing about inventing or these massive creative projects or whatever, but it's like sometimes there are these passions of making people feel good, communicating with a child, you know, bringing new information to light, where we do it in every single context of our lives. And that's how you often know that it's your genius, is because you do it everywhere.
Yeah, it's like, so am I capturing your definition correctly if I say, I was going to ask you the question, is there a difference between having genius and being genius? Do I say I am a genius or that I have genius? And your definition would lead more toward, in my understanding right now, of having a genius as the verb, is that I'm experiencing a genius and I have a genius at this moment or throughout my life. It's not necessarily where I'm braggadocious saying I am a genius.
Exactly. And by the way, a little historical definition on the word genius, it was, I think, I want to say in the 1700s where the definition of genius took a turn. It used to be, and I think genius is Latin, I could be wrong, it might be something else, but it was originally meant to define the essence of someone's spirit. So I would say, you know,
oh, really?
Genius. Yeah, like the essence of his spirit, the essence of Charlie's spirit, what meant genius. And then at a certain point, I think it was 1700s, it shifted around this idea of achievement, right? That you're a genius if you have this, you know, innovation or inspiration or invention with a capital I. And so it shifted over time, but the original definition was around the essence of someone's spirit. And I think that is the truer definition of genius, the essence of someone's spirit. It's just who they are, and they focus the light of the creative source of the universe through that in their passion to be who they are. You are, Charlie, someone who loves making people feel good, and you do that everywhere. You focus all of that energy into these moments where you get to do that, and that is genius. That is your genius. That is a gift that you get to share with the world, and it makes you feel good in the process.
And therefore, in light of that definition, genius or achievement is just a byproduct of the genius.
Right. And the point of, like, who's measuring achievement, right?
Are you right, exactly.
For this particular thing, like, well, does fame determine achievement? Like, again, if we were to do that, then Van Gogh would not be in
right.
his own life considered
right.
a genius, right? So, again, right. we got to take genius out from being evaluated by the outside world. And internally, how do we know that we're expressing our genius? Because we're in our passion, because we're doing things that make us feel good, because we're excited about it, because we love to get better and better at it, because it delights us to get better and better at it, right?
Okay, I'm still just a little bit, you know, I'm going to bring up, before we move into our strategies, I'm going to bring up a couple of pushback ideas just because I'm curious. Is there a difference between being really good at something and being genius?
That's a great question. I would say, I got to think about that, because I would say yes and no. Okay, so let's break that down, right? So
okay.
Let's take Tim Gazer, my wine tasting example, since we talked about him earlier. There are moments of pure genius when he tastes a wine. There are also times when he's just very good at it, right? It's not like there's these brilliant moments every time. You know, and let's take you, for example, since we were talking about you enjoying making people feel good. There are moments where you just had a moment of pure brilliance in that. And there are moments
right.
where it was just pretty good. And so if we're using, like, this idea that we need to be 100% in every moment to say that we're a genius, like, this doesn't happen, right? Genius is a process. And we try new things out, and we try to get better as we go because we enjoy it. But it's not like every moment is this, like, capital G genius moment. And yet we have those. Now, what I will also say, though, is, like, here at Zappa on my team, I work with a team of people, and some of them are junior in their careers, and they're just okay at what they do because they're young. They haven't had all of the trial and error and experience and that continuous improvement loop that makes us better. And yet, even young in their careers and in some of their skill development, they have moments of genius inside of that. Now, are they operating at this, like, crazy high level, the best in the world? Not yet. They're not old enough yet, or they haven't developed a strategy enough yet, or they haven't focused enough yet. And yet there's still moments of genius inside that.
So I'm getting the feeling, is genius contextual? That it has to do with the context that you're in and the contextual and environmental of where you are? Are you at the right place at the right time? Like, because I'm thinking, My desire to make people feel good about themselves. Well, there are some people in more desperate need of that than others, and the ones that have the more desperate need are the ones where I would say, in your terms, because I'm still reticent, but in your terms, that those are genius moments for me. But it requires someone else to have that need that I can impact even greater. Does that make sense?
When you say you have the need to impact even greater, say more about that.
Oh, that I have, no, maybe not the need, the opportunity to impact even greater. It's not the need, it's the opportunity, because this person is really in need of someone encouraging them and telling them that they are really good, good at being who they are and whatever that situation is at that time. And other times, I just do it naturally and people walk away feeling good. There's other times people walk away feeling life changed.
You know, it's funny you say that because I can't tell you. So this is this idea, right? When it's really our gift to share, life gives us all these interesting opportunities to share it. I can't tell you how many people I sit next to on an airplane or run into in a grocery store or manage to hang out in the DMV with or whatever that's going through some career crisis, because one thing I love doing is helping people on the path of their passion and develop their career in that sense or around that. And so life gives me all these random opportunities to do that, and most of them unpaid, by the way. But it's a gift I love sharing, and it makes me feel good, and they felt good in the exchange. So when it's your gift to share, life keeps giving you chances to share the gift. And I don't really know the mechanics of that other than we just are these energetic matches of I have something to share, somebody needs something, and life brings us together.
Yeah, you know, and this concept, you know, as I've talked about this last week with a couple of other people, life coaches, mentors, and they all, or, well, the three people that I talked to, all agreed with you that we all have a genius. I mean, that was just sort of taken as norm by then, and yet it's such a controversial subject. That is very difficult to grasp, and I think we have a fear of doing it just because we feel like, who am I to say that I'm a genius? And yet it really is up to me to say that, up to me to feel that, and up to me to say that. Like we were talking offline last week, and I'm sitting across from my producer who's dying to chirp in right now. You know, he's got a ton of questions, but there's several people that do what he does in producing a radio show, and yet he is genius at it. I look at the way he works, at the people that he has on the show, how he's encouraged them, how he's up the numbers and up the content level because of his genius of understanding what it takes to run a radio show, what it takes to get guests, what it takes to get good hosts, what it takes, the mechanics of editing and all of that stuff that I don't even want to think about because I have a hard enough time putting on headphones and speaking into a microphone, figuring out the logistics of that, let alone figuring out the logistics. So Paul has a genius in that, and it's nice that he can be reminded by you and I, but it's also even nicer that he recognizes, if he can recognize that in himself, and that will literally change the way he interacts with his job.
It's so true, and nothing makes me happier. I swear nothing lights my heart more than seeing someone recognize their own genius and their own gift. And I agree with you. I think Paul is a genius at this. And so I want to use this opportunity to say genius is also a frequency. It's an energy. It's something that you feel in somebody when they do what they love and they're good at it.
That's really good.
That. Yeah.
It's a frequency and an energy. It's not a clear brick and mortar definable noun.
Correct.
And Paul is dying to interject right now.
How do you find this energy?
Well, that's what we're going to talk about later.
And how do you focus it? How do you dial it in?
I don't want you to answer that question because the whole second half of the show after we take a break, that's what it's going to be about. That is it. So let's take this. I'm going to ask everybody to play along, and whether you believe it or not, I want you to assume that you have a genius and that you have geniusing moments. And Taryn is going to help define for us how you and I can discover our genius. So you ready to do that after the break, Taryn?
I'm ready.
Okay, so let's take a quick break and we'll be back. Hi, this is Charlie Hedges, and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And boy, are we into a controversial subject today, yet something I think is so important for each of us individually. And the idea is that every one of us possesses genius, And it's defined as, I like the way Taryn defined it, as a frequency and a something else, Taryn.
A frequency and an energy that you feel when someone is doing what they love and they're good at it.
Yeah, I love that. I think that it's just a beautiful definition. A frequency and an energy you feel when something, when someone is doing something they're very good at. Now, here's going to be my question, and I'd like to spend the second half of our show and talk about how can I and Paul and our listeners discover our genius. I know you have some strategies, so can we get into that? Because I think that will help define genius even more as we get in deeper into that.
It will. And over the years, I've practiced with a lot of different questions because everybody wants to know what's my genius or what am I good at or what's my passion. I have no idea. And I can't tell you how many people I run into, you know, that go through the world that have no idea what their passion even is. And it's interesting because, and I think we talked about this on our last show last week, is it's not like we have an education system or a work system or corporate system that allows us to really express that passion and to, you know, like experiment with life and see what does light us up. So,
or to even think that way.
Well, exactly.
We don't have permission
that way. So we find ourselves later in life wanting to be something, doing something we're passionate about, and yet having no idea how to find that or know what our gifts are. So I've tested a lot of questions over the years to try to help people narrow in on that for themselves. And the one that I think gets the closest to it, and anyone listening, I would invite you to follow along, which is just to think about something that you really enjoy doing. And it's not always necessarily a task, meaning like I love cooking. It could be I love making people feel good about themselves, or I love it when kids feel great about themselves, or I love it when I get to bring people together and share space together, you know, or have fun together, or I love dancing. You know, like it could be anything. Like what's something that you do that brings you joy that you make time to do on some level? And inside that, I can pretty much guarantee you the element of genius is present in that. And it's because, like I said earlier, I've never, ever in my time researching genius seen genius present without there being some level of excitement or passion or interest or joy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's no way, you know, you mentioned that Einstein didn't consider himself a genius, but he devoted the bulk of his time apart from his work to math.
And he loved it.
I mean,
he
loved it. Yeah, he found great joy.
Yeah. You know, so...
Would it be
for that for people, huh?
I'm thinking creatively right now, Taryn. And I'm wondering that this may take too long if I do this, but I'm wondering, what if we use Paul as the guinea pig and took him through these strategies to discover his genius? Do you think we could do that?
I do.
Okay. The only thing I'm going to ask of Paul is I'm just gave him a signal, so he knows what I'm asking of him. So
keep
Paul,
it short.
A little loud. So Paul, answering or addressing Terrence's first question.
Yes.
What brings you joy? What are you excited about?
I love telling stories, and listening to stories.
Taryn, this is you. I brought up the question. You're in charge now.
That's my first reaction. I'm sure there's lots of things, but we're sitting in a studio. One of the things I love about this, I just love listening to all these stories and telling stories. I'm an old storyteller.
That's great.
I'm Irish.
Yeah, I love it. And what's in it for you? Like, what do you get out of it when you get to both tell stories and listen to stories? What's, like, the motivation in that for you? How does it make you feel, or what do you get to experience that you like?
I seem to have an insatiable curiosity. So it immediately wants me to ask for more. Tell me more. Or I want to tell
and
more.
And when you... Right. And so when you get that of like, oh, my gosh, I'm so curious, is it the feeling that you get of like you love that feeling of like, oh, my God, I'm so interested. Tell me more. Or what's the feeling that you love so much?
I've never thought about that. I'm not sure. I have to think about it. I sort of get lost in it. Does that make sense? I've seen the other things. If you're, somebody's really passionate in something, you get lost in it. Time mm-hmm. disappears. I find myself getting lost in a good story, and all of a sudden I look up and, oh my goodness, the hour's gone by.
Yeah, that's great. So this is step one, if we're going to kind of walk through an example with Paul, and I'll break it down for the audience here. This is step one. Number one is, what do you love, and what about it do you love? Like, how does it make you feel? Meaning, like, what's the motivation? What are you getting out of it that makes you want to keep doing more of it? In this case, either telling stories or listening to stories.
Can I inject one thing, though? This feels sort of like going through therapy a little bit, like I did years ago. And I'm a good Midwesterner. I'm not in touch with my feelings. I'm not in touch with this sort of, what is touchy-feely, what does it feel like? That makes me uncomfortable when you start saying all that.
I'll challenge that.
Do you?
You're very in touch with your feelings. You just were, as you talked, and as we have talked, you talk very much from passion-oriented, feelings-oriented. It's not all logical.
And yeah.
Your logic is motivated by your passion.
Right. And I agree with that. And I actually love that question, Paul, because you're not unique in feeling that way, because here's the mechanics of what's happening, right? Because you love it, it's a part of your soul. And it touches on something a little bit spiritual of like an essence of who you are. And mm-hmm. that's a little uncomfortable to talk about. And so it is a little uncomfortable, and I honor that, because it's that idea. And I think the reason that a lot of us don't express our passions is it's because it reveals an aspect of our soul. And if we were to be rejected, it would reject us on such a soul level we may not recover.
That's true.
And so sometimes we don't pursue it because we couldn't handle the rejection that would happen if we were laughed at. But in your case, you do pursue this. You're courageous. And you love it, and yet it's kind of emotional to talk about it or uncomfortable, because it's spiritual in the sense of it is an aspect of your spirit.
Reminds me of a friend of mine I knew many years ago, a real tough New Yorker, and worked in construction. And he and I were roommates at one point in time in a house, we were a bunch of other guys. And years after I knew him, I discovered he had a passion for poetry. But he was too embarrassed, and I have to say, I probably laughed at him too, because you don't picture this big tough guy talking about poetry and stuff, like Rocky Balboa. And I never heard him talk about it again. I mean, I can see that. I'm sure it's something he genuinely felt, but it seemed so out of touch with who he'd been raised to be that he couldn't really express it. Maybe that's it. Maybe we're just raised to block this.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a great example. Thanks for bringing that up, because I think all of us have a way to relate to that story of your roommate, you know, where it's something that we love, but we hide because we're embarrassed about it on some way, or we don't feel like we can show all of ourselves to the world. And yet we love it, so we do it kind of in secret.
Charlie's a ballerina dancer. I don't know if he's shared that with you or not. But no.
You know, Charlie's an artist, and it's only been in recent times that he's come out of the closet with his artwork.
Yeah.
You know, for a long time he didn't. So it's the same thing.
Didn't even know about it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So we've addressed the first question in the therapy session. let's go to another level. Let's go to point two.
Yeah, so the next way to, I sort of say, deconstruct or discover your genius is to think of a time, and in your case, Paul, and for anyone listening, think of a time you were at your best, a time where you can pick one where you maybe told a story, right? Where you told a story and you were at your best. And I want a very specific time, like it was 2 weeks ago on a Thursday when I was blah, 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 right? Like a very specific moment when you were at your best doing that thing that you love. Because it's important to put ourselves back there so that we can remember what our strategies were.
And access our feelings and all.
And access what we really did to be good at that. So I'll just give you an example. I was recently having this conversation about helping someone discover their genius, and she loves creating interior spaces that are peaceful and zen-like. And she recently remodeled her closet, and you think, oh my gosh, a closet being zen-like, turns out it's possible. And so that was her example. She's like, well, I recently remodeled my closet, and so I made her take herself back to that time where right before she began the project. So, Paul, in your case, take yourself right back to that time before you told a great story. And maybe you can give us a little bit of context about like what it was, and we don't need all the details, just like a sentence or two.
I'm surprisingly struggling. I've got a couple that sort of come to mind, and I'm sure I'll think of some later. That's my first thought is, oh, I'll think, why didn't I say that one?
Anyone's okay, as long as you felt good about it.
The one that comes to my mind for some reason, the first one that comes to my mind is a very strange one. My father died a few years ago, and I struggled. We're Irish, so we wanted to have a party afterwards, and I had to get up and say a few words. So I had to tell stories of my dad. How do you pick a story or two out of who your dad was to you? And I told a couple of stories of that he had related to me of his being a bomber pilot and whatnot. And just everybody could seem to connect with it. It seemed to capsulize.
I love this example. This is a great one. Okay, so put yourself back there before you got up on the stage and mm-hmm. had to tell these stories, even maybe before you decided which stories to tell.
Right.
I'm sure that was a process, right? So
right.
put yourself back there like you transported back in time and you were back in that moment right before you had to do this activity. And now the next question I'm going to ask you, you're going to have to access some stuff you've never thought about before,
mm-hmm.
but it's everything in this question.
Uh-oh.
Put yourself back there.
Okay.
And what are your goals? This moment, what are your goals?
My first goal in that one was to honor my father. I don't want to get choked up, but to honor his wishes. This was a big moment to him. His funeral and the party afterwards meant he talked about it endlessly. And so I had to get this, as his only child, as his only son, I had to get this right.
That's great. Honor my father and his wishes and get it right.
Yeah, get it right. Right.
Okay, that's great. And then what else are your goals as you think about telling stories or which stories to tell?
It was making that event work. A story somehow makes a connection and makes an impression in somebody that nothing else does. I can tell you facts all day long.
Okay, great. So one of your goals is to tell a story that makes an impression on someone. Is that the right way to say it?
Yeah, right. I wanted everybody to go away and have a positive impression of my father, an accurate impression of who we were, and to honor his wishes that this just be a wonderful occasion and everybody'd remember it.
Okay, great. Now, think of the stories that you picked.
Uh-huh.
Or maybe just one particular story, the one about maybe the bomber story, I think you said.
Mm-hmm.
And think about, what are your goals right before you tell that story? What are you really trying to achieve as you tell a story? So it's like focus it down to the actual story. What are your goals in telling the story?
Put people there. Put people in another place. Take them, help them see something from another point of view.
I love that. Okay, so put people there in another place and help them see something from another point of view.
Right.
I love that. That's a great goal. What other goals do you have?
You're making this tough here. What other goals did I have here? Mm-hmm. In telling that story or telling any story?
In this one in particular, right, because we're going to use one, and the pattern will be the same across any of these you do, so we just pick the one where you're the best or one you felt good about. And so, like, a goal might be, and I'm just using examples here to help you jog your thinking a little bit, might be I wanted to tell it in a way that had a certain cadence or that was somewhat funny or, you know, like, what are your goals?
Well, yeah, this was a funny story, so we're Irish. Everything has to be a funny story. You're very careful about making it funny.
Okay, so one of your goals is to make it funny.
Right.
Yeah, and say more about the timing.
Timing is everything in making something funny.
Okay, so one of your goals was to make it funny and make sure the timing was just right?
Yeah. You don't want to go be too long. You want to be too short. You want everybody to laugh. And I thought the story was told to give you some insight, point how different things were in his time. To give you an understanding of what he went through.
So there's a narrative arc in that.
Yeah.
Yes, right. Yeah. Should I tell the story real quick? It's a pretty quick story. No, Charlie says don't tell the story. I'll tell the story. It's a real quick story. My dad was a bomb, had never been in a plane. Goes to fight World War II. We put him up in a bomb, train him to fly a bomb. He flies up the first day. Half the planes don't come back. I said, I got how they get you to fly the first one. How the heck did they get you to go up the second day? How did they get you to go back up and do that again? He said, it's our duty. You just don't think about it.
powerful.
I said how different things are today.
So did you tell the story just like that, or did you elaborate when you actually delivered it at your father's service?
Well, I might have schmaltzed it up a little bit here, but I'll tell you, another goal of a story is to provoke another story.
One of your goals in telling a story is to provoke another story.
Yes, because then a Vietnam veteran came, a son of another guy who was younger than my dad, came up to me and said how different things were. He said, I was a chopper pilot in Vietnam, and when they told us to go up in the rough missions, we rolled grenades into their tents. You know, we didn't take that. We fragged them.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, wow, okay, that's a different response. So, okay, guys, take that hill again. F you.
But it sounds like you loved it. You told a story, then you got to listen to a story. Right?
Yes, that's always great. Uh-huh. When I tell somebody tells a story and somebody comes back with an even more interesting story or a different story that plays on it, then I'm really caught up in it.
Yeah. Okay, so now we could go on, and if you were sitting in my studio, we could certainly deconstruct this further, but I want to emphasize the point of goals, because I am not a natural storyteller, and as I hear you, I think, wow, that's really great strategy. And so let me just repeat it for the audience, which was, you had some goals for the event, which was to honor your father and his wishes and to get it right,
yes.
And to make the event work. But really, if I just kind of take out the event from the story, your goal in telling a story is to make an impression on someone in a way that facts and figures just can't.
Yes.
And that you wanted everyone to be there, to be in another place, and to help to see something from another point of view.
Yeah.
And another goal is to make it funny. And of course, in being funny, timing is everything. It can't be too long. It can't be too short, but everyone's got to laugh. And in that, a goal is to help provoke another story, either another story that sounds like you tell or that someone tells you.
Yeah.
And so you kind of keep the storytelling going, right? Now, those are beautiful goals. Like, I've never thought about the last one, provoke another story. Now, my point in this is, you can see then how the behavior, the what you do, is in service to achieving these goals.
Right.
And this is great strategy. So for someone wanting to become a good storyteller, you know, how do you start with a good set of goals? And another storyteller might have a very different set of goals, because we all have our own twist on it,
sure.
In a sense, right?
So do you have to articulate these? Do you have to know what it is going in, or is this an instinct that you develop?
These are all very subconscious. So what happens with goals is we develop these goal lists very, very subconsciously, and they just happen over time, or they happen intuitively. So you never probably thought about this until this very moment.
No,
and you've
never.
Gone however many years of your life being a great storyteller. So our goals don't need to be conscious in order to be great, high-quality goals. It's just that when you make them conscious like we just did here, you can tend to get better at what you do, and you can even add to the goals or tweak them a little bit to get better, right? So if someone's learning how to be a great storyteller or a great artist or, you know, cook or whatever, right? Like, listening to other people's goals is really interesting, because it helps you refine and get better at your own. So if you ever want to learn how somebody does something, do what we just did, which is have them pick a time when they were great at it, transport themselves back there, and then before they begin that activity, think of what their goals were in the activity as they do it, right? It's really powerful. So it's like the sauce is in here. That's the focus, right? That's the prism of focus is those goals. And then, you know, there's a lot more. I don't know what kind of time we have. There's a lot more strategies. And I'll just maybe talk about them.
How many strategies do we have, Taryn? Did you say five?
There's one out of five, but I'm just going to mention the other ones. We won't go into them. I don't know that we have time. But,
we've got a little time. I'm having fun here.
Great. All right. So the next one is, the degree that somebody's good at something is the degree to which they do the following thing very well, which is look at things from multiple points of view. And there's really three points of view to consider. Your own point of view. What are you seeing as you look out into the world, or as you look out onto this thing that you're focusing on, right? That's what we call the first point of view. The second point of view is looking at it from somebody, a very specific person's point of view. And by the way, I've also seen this from an object or an animal, right? But like one other thing, like, you know, if I were to step into my dog, how would my dog see this? But in your case, how would I step into an audience member, and how would they be perceiving this? You know, this moment that I want to share, right? So it's the first position is ours, second is somebody else's or something else's. And then the third is kind of pulling back and looking at it as an aggregate, like how would you see the whole room, including yourself in that, right? Sort of pulling out and kind of looking at it a bit more objectively, almost like you're watching a movie of it in a sense.
And that's all. And it, I never thought of it this way, but that's really a good way to define what makes a good radio show. Not just that you're presenting your own thoughts well and pulling out other thoughts from other people, but that you're thinking of it from the point of view of the audience. What are they hearing? What would they be asking?
Yeah, and it's funny because I think this is a really a beautiful skill that you carry, and you do it in all these contexts as you tell a story, as you run a radio show, right? It's the same gift in a sense, yeah. Now exercised in these different contexts. And so if we're not good at something, it's usually because we're not considering it from one of those points of view as well as we could. We're not putting ourselves in someone else's shoes. We're not putting ourselves in the shoes of a broader audience. And if we can do that more consciously, we'll just get a lot better at it, at what we're doing. So that's really the second strategy of genius. And when you see somebody really good at what they do, it's because they're quite good at this one, is seeing things from all three of those points of view. So it makes perfect sense why you're a great storyteller, why you're a great radio show producer, because you're really good at this piece. Now, the third thing is when we engage multiple senses, and those are what are we seeing, hearing, feeling, touching, tasting, sensing, right? Like all the different senses that we have. And usually this is very subconscious, right? But it's like when you're, if you think of the wine taster we talked about earlier, he's engaging all of his senses to evaluate a wine. You know, what am I tasting? What am I sensing? What am I feeling in my body? You know, how is the structure of this, right? Like all these, what am I looking at in terms of color of a wine? So in your case, Paul, what are some of the senses you engage as you tell a story? Beyond just telling of the story, like what are you seeing, hearing, feeling?
You have to, if you really want to tell a story well, you have to bring in as many of those other senses as possible. What does it sound like? What does it feel like? To put somebody there, you have to bring those other senses in. I took years of short story writing, and that was one of the things they're always trying to drill into us. Don't just say it was a pretty house, or it was a pretty field. What did it feel like? What did it smell like? What did it sound like? Then you transport people there.
That's just perfect. This is such a great example for this radio show, too. Because to your point on storytelling, you have to engage those multiple senses. And so when somebody's really good at something, and again, it can be wine tasting or talking to kids or project managing, always if someone's good, multiple senses are engaged, just like you said, but in particular, storytelling is a great one, right? So Maybe the audience is thinking, you know, how do they, like, what am I seeing, hearing, feeling? Like, how am I engaging all those senses? Now, the next one is...
Food is a big one that does that. You see a lot of people where they'll have a food memory that they'd forgotten about. The smell of your mother's bread. And you'll the smell of a pie that you hadn't smelled in years. The smell of a flower. Smell of perfume that you haven't smelled in years.
Yeah, so it's not food, it's smell.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And smell is the only one of our senses that bypasses the neocortex and goes straight into the memory, like
really?
The memory file.
Oh, yeah, it's so powerful.
That's why you're so quickly transported back into a memory file when with smells. Smells are great. They're powerful.
Yeah.
Now, the next one is one that I believe we discovered for the first time on the planet at the Everyday Genius Institute, which is how people use what I call mental templates or checklists. And I'm going to give you an example so as you think about this for yourself. So as the wine taster we've been talking about tastes the wine, this was very, very subconscious, and he didn't know he did this. But after we pulled it out of him, what he does is as he's tasting a wine, he's going through a mental checklist. You know, what's the fruit, non-fruit, earth, mineral, oak, and then acid, alcohol, tannin, finish.
Mm-hmm.
And he's evaluating each thing on a mental checklist. Another guy that we interviewed was a copywriter who writes advertising copy for high-tech companies like Apple and TiVo and whatnot. And as he's writing advertising copy for magazines, his mental checklist when he's done is, does it look right? Does it sound right? Does it have the right shape? And will the reader take action? And so he's got this checklist and he's checking it off. And so just a third example, just to kind of make it interesting, is a good friend of mine is a really, really amazing horse healer. She works with horses and she does both chiropractic work and energy medicine and that kind of work. And she's got this mental checklist of how she goes about her sessions with a horse. And she does, I don't know, like 10 a day. And, you know, she's got this whole checklist, like, what do I see when they walk around the first time? You know, how do I do this? How do I do that? And then how do I make them walk around again to test my work? And so it's a checklist of how she runs through a session. And so as you think about telling a story, Paul, what kind of, in the back of your mind, template or checklist are you using to tell the story to know that you're on point?
I didn't invent this. It's something I had to learn along the way, but it's a good beginning, a good middle, and a good end. It's a three-act play. It has to start, you set it up, and then it takes you through some sort of journey, and then it comes to some resolution, conclusion.
The proverbial narrative arc.
Proverbial narrative arc, yep.
Okay, now that's
the hero's journey.
Yeah, the hero's journey, it's great. It's got a good beginning. You set it up. It's got a good middle. You take them through the process, and it has a good end. It kind of wraps it up into the point you're trying to make. But what else is on that checklist if you kind of think about it? Like, what else are you, like, okay, I know it had a good beginning, middle, and end, but what else? Because lots of stories have good beginning, middles, and ends. What's the secret sauce you put in it?
Personal. Vulnerable. But opens up some part of you or some part of them. That pulls people in. It makes a connection. Gee, I'm not the only one. I had that feeling. I had that fear. I felt like that. Makes it relatable.
That's very powerful, because what you're doing there is you're creating pathos and ethos. You're creating compassion, that people mm-hmm. understand that you're compassionate about this and that you really do care about your father and them, but also the ethos, and I, you know, which is Greek for integrity, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, can I trust you? And as you're telling this story, and the way you're telling this story, you're telling it to me in a way that I can trust you. I can trust whether the facts are right or not, the ethos is right.
Mm-hmm.
The feeling that I want to come away with,
mm-hmm.
that's what the important point is.
Which then decides whether or not I'm going to buy this, I'm going to swallow this, I'm going to accept this, I'm going to believe this.
That's great.
Wow.
So let me just replay that back to you, right? So what I heard you say is that you do run through a checklist as you craft a story, which is there's a good beginning, check, good middle, check, good end, check. It's personal, check, and it's vulnerable and relatable, and it pulls people in, and it creates a connection, check.
Now, if you do all those, and you can, I can't explain how, but you can feel it, you can see it, you can gauge it. It helps if you can see the audience, but on radio you can't see the audience, so you have to, you kind of feel that. It's got that rhythm to it. It's got that pace to it. It hits those moments. Like Charlie just took something. Charlie did a perfect example. I said something, and then it brought something out in him that added another layer of insight to it. That's a perfect, to me, a perfect story combination. That's a perfect result.
Right.
That's beautiful. I love that, which achieves that goal of, you know, provoking another story. Okay, so in your mind, again, you probably never thought about this, but back to when we're really good at something, we have these mental checklists or templates that we're operating from, because we can't reinvent the wheel every time. And as we get better and better, our checklist gets more and more streamlined. And so...
And what improves those checklists? Yeah. Is it a learned behavior you do and you learn, gee, this one they laughed, this one they didn't laugh, this one really connected, this one didn't? It's like a comedian up on stage, you're just trying material out over and over again until you get a feeling for how to deliver it?
Yeah, you know, you just nailed it on the head, which is the last point ties into exactly what you just said, which is everybody who's good at something or a genius operating at a genius level at something has a continuous improvement loop. They keep trying new stuff,
yes,
which is why nobody ever feels like a genius, because most of your stuff isn't great the first time out, right? You got to get better and better and better. And that's what improves that checklist. As we try out new material or new ways or new approaches or strategies and push our own edge, our checklists that get better and better because we've got we streamline it through that process of continuous improvement.
How many different materials did Thomas Edison try when he was trying to build a filament in a light bulb that would keep burning? It's like 1,000. He tried human hair. He tried all sorts of crazy things.
Until he found it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he just kept getting better and better and trying to figure out what worked and what didn't. And, you know, and I'm sure his mental checklist got more and more streamlined as he learned more about what didn't work.
Now, tell me, Taryn, is that process that who were you just talking about?
Thomas Edison.
Edison and Paul went through. Is that process?
I like that company that you're putting me in.
Yeah.
Thomas Edison.
Is that process of self improvement, getting better at it? Does that mean you're getting better at your genius or that you are becoming genius?
Or that you're focused, learning how to focus this energy better. You're saying there's some inner energy that's got.
Yeah, you just took us in a different direction.
Okay.
Let's do my question and then we'll do yours.
Okay.
So does he begin with a genius or does a genius develop in situ, in process?
Yeah, let's just use Thomas Edison. I love this example. Was Thomas Edison a genius the first time he had the idea to make a light bulb and tried the first 100 materials? Was he a genius? No, he was only a genius after he finally figured it out after years of practice and 1,000 trials and error. Right? So that's where I think genius is a verb. He was in the process. He had an idea, and he kept working at it and working at it and working at it and getting better and better and better as he learned more each time. Right? So, you know, was Steve Jobs a genius when he had an idea for, you know, thing? No, he was a genius after he made $100 million and everybody, you know, used his first machine. Do you know what I mean? It's like, at what point do you qualify genius? And that's why I say genius is a verb. We are in process of it because we had an inspiration, we love doing it, and we keep getting better and better. And that is the process of genius.
But is the genius how to focus this? Is the genius how to find the idea? Is the genius how to find the process to make it a reality? Or is it the genius is just... there's some energy you're sort of describing that's focusing it like a prism. That's a great image. Adjusting the prism until it's finally comes into focus here.
Yeah, and we're the prism, and we're the ones doing the focusing, right? So what is it? You know, sometimes people have these aha moments, and it's an idea, and that triggers all of this focus onto it. Sometimes we just love doing it, like telling stories or dancing or whatever. There's not this, like, aha moment, I should go invent this thing. It's like, I just love doing it. And then inside of that, I have these moments of inspiration, right? Like, oh, man, what if I told this story? Or what if I did this in this new dance move or whatever, right?
So right.
It's not like it's linear. Like, genius is not linear. Like, first it's this, and then it's that, and then we do this, right? Like, it's sometimes genius starts with a passion. Sometimes it starts with a light bulb moment. Sometimes it just kind of comes to us slowly over time as we work on something, and then we find that we enjoy it, and we want to get better and better at it, right? So... there's no formula. It's very non-linear, and of course people like linear things, but it's not, right? I mean, a lot of people got their start because an idea came to them first, and then they focused their passion and their talent around that. And some people they're born with some innate passion to tell a story, you know?
You know what I'm thinking of, Taryn, as you're describing this in another context? I'm thinking of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking of the great comedy acts that fill stadiums, the Kevin Harts of the world that fill stadiums. Well, he began that act, not he began his career as a comedian, but he began that act at a tiny little comedy club.
Absolutely.
And just got all the boos and the negative things and just kept working it, kept working it, kept
right.
working it, kept working it until... He is a genius at comedy. There is no doubt that he is genius at comedy. But you would not think of that the first time you saw this act.
No.
You would say, how does this guy pack stadiums? And I'll tell you, a wonderful television show that does that, I think it's a Netflix show, it's The Marvelous Miss Maisie. And it's talking about this woman who's up and coming in comedy and what she has to do. But I think that's interesting, Taryn. Is that the genius? And please correct me, but I'm just kind of following along here. The genius is latent within us anyway. You know, to begin, it is there. You know, I like your idea of the passion, goals, and inspiration. But the passion, there's something that I feel really strongly about. And I developed that as time, and so the genius has always been there, but the genius is expressed over hard work and much work and much contemplation and understanding the goals.
And there's a process to bring it out.
Right. Would you agree with that?
I think, exactly, there is a process, and it is true. It's funny, you say work, the thing of it is, though, it doesn't usually feel like work because we
enjoy
it. I mean, yes, there are those moments, but... you're not thinking it's work as you think about how do I make this person feel good. You love doing it, so it's like a fun thing to do, right? You know,
exactly.
And stories.
Exactly.
I think there's moments where it feels like work, but more often than not, it probably feels like fun, right?
Well, this feels like a place for the conclusion. Because I got to do a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah, and we are, this is the longest podcast we've ever done.
Yes.
But and we could go longer. Taryn, this is incredible. So for our audience, the beginning place for our audience to discover their genius is to discover their passion, is to identify their passion. And you do that by what you love to do, and I also like to add to that, it's either what do you love to do or what makes you excited when you do it. Sort of the same question put two different ways. And that's the beginning, that's the first step to discovering your genius. Would you agree?
I would. And sometimes passion gets people jammed up because they think passion needs to look like this thing that takes over your life. Sometimes it's just a simple pleasure. Like, what's a simple pleasure that you enjoy doing that you try to do more of?
I would do anything to get rid of the word passion because it's been so abused.
Yeah, I think it does jam people up. I don't know what my passion is. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I have a passion.
But you do know what you like to do, what you love to do, what makes you excited. You do know that.
Right.
And you're passionate about it when you do those.
Exactly.
So it's really quite simple question.
And then if I remember correctly, she puts you back in that time and place so you can start to break it down. How did that passion feel? And what were you thinking? And what thoughts went through your mind? And what was your goals? And making
it happen. Yeah, so it's all that strategy. Like, what's the how? So you love telling stories, but how are you good at it? Start with what are your goals? Put yourself back in a time where you were really great at that thing, put yourself back there and think, okay, before I start this activity, what are my goals? And you can list them out. And a lot of them are very subconscious and, you know, stay with it as you do it. And it's like, yeah, those are maybe my goals. And what's in it for me personally is another goal to add. Why do I do this? Why do I like doing this? What am I getting out of it? And so those goals are really inform a lot. And then there's the other strategies that we talked about, processing things from three points of view, engaging multiple senses, using mental templates and checklists, and then employing that continuous improvement loop. And inside all of that are those moments of inspiration and intuition that we get. And those are those moments of kind of like the light of the divine coming through us in these little like bits of light where we go, oh, we should do that. Or wouldn't that be a great idea? Or what if I tried this?
I always described it as God spoke to me. It really feels like somebody speaks to you at that moment when you suddenly say something funny or write something well or come up with some inspiration to do it a different way. And you say, where did that come from? And that's the one I think jams up a lot of people, too. They don't know how, they don't trust that it's going to come, and they don't know how to let it come, let it out.
Yeah. And people often ask that, you know, how do you let that out? And honestly, it's in a place of being excited and enjoy, and then also being relaxed. It's pretty hard to be genius when you're super stressed out. You know, it's why we get our good ideas in the shower when we're driving or when we're on the treadmill.
Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
That is so true.
It is true, yeah.
In the shower or driving, you know, some of my best ideas.
For me, it's when I'm in that twilight moment when I'm not asleep and I'm not awake. Like you're sort of napping, you close your eyes and you're sort of napping or you're sort of like zoning out a little. There's a period of time between sleep and awakeness that I find the most inspirations come to me for some reason.
That's great. And so when people say, how can I be a better genius? I'd say relax more, you know, spend more time in the car, in the shower, in those twilight moments. And so those are the things, and because I love your beginning, middle, and end, Paul, what I want to say is thank you for letting me share in your genius. I truly honor your gift and your genius. It's a delight. I love it because I get to learn something every time about how somebody does something, and it's a way of thinking that I never think of, so I love that.
Your genius was getting to bring it out in us here. I hadn't thought of it as a process before.
That's what she claims her genius is in writing.
Yeah, right. Because most people, I think, to start to Charlie's point, we'll start where we ended, think a genius is there. Ta-da, you got it. I don't have it. You got it. I can't have it.
I'm very pleased with the direction of this. Taryn, now I know you haven't documented all these things because you've been working on them, so I don't have a place to send people to find these five strategies. So they're just going to have to listen to the tape a couple times.
Yeah, right.
They are. And, you know, it's funny. I've been wanting to really put this together in a downloadable material, and I will. And in the meantime, people can visit me at taryn.voget.com and find me and message me, and I can certainly share more of this if anyone's interested.
So spell your name. Spell that.
Yes, Taryn Voget, T-A-R-Y-N, V is in victory, O-G-E-T as in Tom, TarynVoget.com.
I will have that in the show notes. Taryn, once again, you're amazing. We love having you on the show. And to all our listeners, I hope that you can begin the process of discovering your genius, because you do have one. I gave the pushback in the beginning, but I am a believer in it now, and I'm a believer in certain parts of my life that I am willing to say that I am genius at, but it's been over a process. And Taryn, the process you described is so helpful. So thank you so much. You've been absolutely wonderful, as usual.
Well, thank you for having me. It's such my favorite thing to do. So thank you for letting me participate in the show and to share in both of your gifts and geniuses. It's a pleasure for me. So thank you.
Okay. I also want to thank I want to thank Taryn, I want to thank Paul, and I want to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And I would like to encourage you to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. That's .life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.